Chapter 10. Now I strongly suspect it was strictly in character. At bottom, poor Brierly must have been thinking of himself. I pointed out to him that the skipper of the Patna was known to have feathered his nest pretty well, and could procure almost anywhere the means of getting away. With Jim it was otherwise. The government was keeping him in the sailor's home for the time being, and probably he hadn't a penny in his pocket to bless himself with. It costs some money to run away. Does it? Not always, he said, with a bitter laugh, and to some further remark of mine, "Well, then, let him creep 20 feet underground and stay there. By heavens, I would." I don't know why his tone provoked me, and I said, "There is a kind of courage in facing it out as he does, knowing very well that, if he went away nobody would trouble to run after him." "Courage be hanged," growled Brierly. "That sort of courage is of no use. To keep a man straight, and I don't care a snap for such courage. If you were to say it was a kind of cowardice now of softness. I tell you what, I will put up 200 rupees, if you put up another 100 and undertake to make the beggar clear out early tomorrow morning. The fellow's a gentleman, if he ain't fit to be touched he will understand. He must. This infernal publicity is too shocking. There he sits, while all these confounded natives, serangs, lascars, quartermasters, are giving evidence that's enough to burn a man to ashes with shame. This is abominable. Why, Marlowe, don't you think, don't you feel, that this is abominable? Don't you now come as a seaman? If he went away all this would stop at once." Brierly said these words with a most unusual animation, and made as if to reach after his pocketbook. I restrained him, and declared coldly that the cowardice of these four men did not seem to me a matter of such great importance. "And you call yourself a seaman, I suppose," he pronounced angrily. I said that's what I called myself, and I hoped I was too. He heard me out, and made a gesture with his big arm that seemed to deprive me of my individuality, to push me away into the crowd. "The worst of it," he said, "is that all you fellows have no sense of dignity. You don't think enough of what you are supposed to be." We had been walking slowly meantime, and now stopped opposite the harbor office, in sight of the very spot from which the immense captain of the Patna had vanished as utterly as a tiny feather blown away in a hurricane. I smiled. Brierly went on, "Colin, this is a disgrace. We've got all kinds amongst us some anointed scoundrels in the lot. But, hang it, we must preserve professional decency, or we become no better than so many tinkers going about loose. We are trusted. Do you understand? Trusted. Frankly, I don't care a snap for all the pilgrims that ever came out of Asia, but a decent man would not have behaved like this to a full cargo of old rags in bales. We aren't an organized body of men, and the only thing that holds us together is just the name for that kind of decency. Such an affair destroys one's confidence. A man may go pretty near through his whole sea life without any call to show a stiff upper lip. But when the call comes, he broke off. And in a changed tone, I'll give you 200 rupees now, Marlowe, and you just talk to that chap. Confound him. I wish he had never come out here. Fact is, I rather think some of my people know his. The old man's a parson, and I remember now I met him once, when staying with my cousin in Essex last year. If I am not mistaken, the old chap seemed rather to fancy his sailor son. Horrible. I can't do it myself but you." Thus, apropos of Jim, I had a glimpse of the real Brierly a few days before he committed his reality and his sham together to the keeping of the sea. Of course I declined to meddle. The tone of this last adieu, poor Brierly couldn't help it, that seemed to imply I was no more noticeable than an insect, caused me to look at the proposal with indignation, and on account of that provocation, or for some other reason, I became positive in my mind that the inquiry was a severe punishment to that Jim, and that his facing it practically of his own free will was a redeeming feature in his abominable case. I hadn't been so sure of it before. Brierly went off in a huff. At the time, his state of mind was more of a mystery to me than it is now. Next day, coming into court late, I sat by myself. Of course I could not forget the conversation I had with Brierly, and now I had them both under my eyes. The demeanor of one suggested gloomy impudence, and of the other a contemptuous boredom, yet one attitude might not have been truer than the other, and I was aware that one was not true. Brierly was not bored, he was exasperated. And if so, then Jim might not have been impudent. According to my theory, he was not. I imagined he was hopeless. Then it was that our glances met. They met, and the look he gave me was discouraging of any intention I might have had to speak to him. Upon either hypothesis, insolence or despair, I felt I could be of no use to him. This was the second day of the proceedings. Very soon after that exchange of glances, the inquiry was adjourned again to the next day. The white men began to troop out at once. Jim had been told to stand down some time before, and was able to leave amongst the first. I saw his broad shoulders and his head outlined in the light of the door, and while I made my way slowly out talking with someone, some stranger who had addressed me casually, I could see him from within the courtroom resting both elbows on the balustrade of the veranda, and turning his back on the small stream of people trickling down the few steps. There was a murmur of voices and a shuffle of boots. The next case was that of assault and battery committed upon a money lender, I believe. And the defendant, a venerable villager with a straight white beard, sat on a mat just outside the door with his sons, daughters, sons-in-law, their wives, and, I should think, half the population of his village besides, squatting or standing around him. A slim dark woman, with part of her back and one black shoulder bared, and with a thin gold ring in her nose, suddenly began to talk in a high-pitched, shrewish tone. The man with me instinctively looked up at her. We were then just through the door, passing behind Jim's burly back. Whether those villagers had brought the yellow dog with them, I don't know. Anyhow, a dog was there, weaving himself in and out amongst people's legs in that mute, stealthy way native dogs have, and my companion stumbled over him. The dog leaped away without a sound. The man, raising his voice a little, said with a slow laugh, "Look at that wretched cur," and directly afterwards we became separated by a lot of people pushing in. I stood back for a moment against the wall, while the stranger managed to get down the steps and disappeared. I saw Jim spin round. He made a step forward, and barred my way. We were alone. He glared at me with an air of stubborn resolution. I became aware I was being held up, so to speak, as if in a wood. The veranda was empty by then, the noise and movement in court had ceased. A great silence fell upon the building, in which, somewhere far within, an oriental voice began to whine abjectly. The dog, in the very act of trying to sneak in at the door, sat down hurriedly to hunt for fleas. "Apostrophe, did you speak to me?" asked Jim very low, and bending forward, not so much towards me but at me, if you know what I mean. I said no at once. Something in the sound of that quiet tone of his warned me to be on my defense. I watched him. It was very much like a meeting in a wood, only more uncertain in its issue, since he could possibly want neither my money nor my life, nothing that I could simply give up or defend with a clear conscience. "Why, you say you didn't," he said, very somber. "Be but I heard. Some mistake," I protested, utterly at a loss, and never taking my eyes off him. To watch his face was like watching a darkening sky before a clap of thunder, shade upon shade imperceptibly coming on, the doom growing mysteriously intense in the calm of maturing violence. "Apostrophe, as far as I know, I haven't opened my lips in your hearing," I affirmed with perfect truth. I was getting a little angry too, at the absurdity of this encounter. It strikes me now I have never in my life been so near a beating, I mean it literally. A beating with fists. I suppose I had some hazy prescience of that eventuality, being in the air. Not that he was actively threatening me. On the contrary, he was strangely passive, don't you know, but he was lowering, and, though not exceptionally big, he looked generally fit to demolish a wall. The most reassuring symptom I noticed was a kind of slow and ponderous hesitation, which I took as a tribute to the evident sincerity of my manner and of my tone. We faced each other. In the court, the assault case was proceeding. I caught the words colon well buffalo stick in the greatness of my fear. ... Hat did you mean by staring at me all the morning? Said Jim at last. He looked up and looked down again. Did you expect us all to sit with downcast eyes out of regard for your susceptibilities? I retorted sharply. I was not going to submit meekly to any of his nonsense. He raised his eyes again, and this time continued to look me straight in the face. And no. That's all right, he pronounced with an air of deliberating with himself upon the truth of this statement. That's all right. I am going through with that. Only, and there he spoke a little faster, won't let any man call me names outside this court. There was a fellow with you. You spoke to him, oh yes I know, 'tis all very fine. You spoke to him, but you meant me to hear. I assured him he was under some extraordinary delusion. I had no conception how it came about. Why you thought I would be afraid to resent this, he said, with just a faint tinge of bitterness. I was interested enough to discern the slightest shades of expression, but I was not in the least enlightened. Yet I don't know what in these words, or perhaps just the intonation of that phrase, induced me suddenly to make all possible allowances for him. I ceased to be annoyed at my unexpected predicament. It was some mistake on his part. He was blundering, and I had an intuition that the blunder was of an odious, of an unfortunate nature. I was anxious to end this scene on grounds of decency, just as one is anxious to cut short some unprovoked and abominable confidence. The funniest part was that in the midst of all these considerations of the higher order, I was conscious of a certain trepidation as to the possibility, nay, likelihood of this encounter ending in some disreputable brawl which could not possibly be explained and would make me ridiculous. I did not hanker after a three-day celebrity as the man who got a black eye or something of the sort from the mate of the Patna. He, in all probability, did not care what he did, or at any rate, would be fully justified in his own eyes. It took no magician to see he was amazingly angry about something, for all his quiet and even torpid demeanor. I don't deny I was extremely desirous to pacify him at all costs, had I only known what to do. But I didn't know, as you may well imagine. It was a blackness without a single gleam. We confronted each other in silence. He hung fire for about 15 seconds, then made a step nearer, and I made ready to ward off a blow, though I don't think I moved a muscle. If he were as big as two men, and as strong as six, he said very softly, I would tell you what I think of you. You. Stop. I exclaimed. This checked him for a second. Before you tell me what you think of me, I went on quickly, will you kindly tell me what it is I've said or done? During the pause that ensued, he surveyed me with indignation, while I made supernatural efforts of memory, in which I was hindered by the oriental voice within the courtroom expostulating with impassioned volubility against a charge of falsehood. Then we spoke almost together. I will soon show you I am not, he said, in a tone suggestive of a crisis. I declare I don't know, I protested earnestly at the same time. He tried to crush me by the scorn of his glance. And now that you see I am not afraid, you try to crawl out of it, he said. Who's a cur now, eh? Then, at last, I understood. He had been scanning my features, as though looking for a place where he would plant his fist. I will allow no man, he mumbled threateningly. It was, indeed, a hideous mistake. He had given himself away utterly. I can't give you an idea how shocked I was. I suppose he saw some reflection of my feelings in my face, because his expression changed just a little. Gee, good God! I stammered, you don't think I, but I am sure I've heard, he persisted, raising his voice for the first time since the beginning of this deplorable scene. Then with a shade of disdain he added, it wasn't you, then? Very well, I'll find the other. Dee, don't be a fool, I cried in exasperation. It wasn't that at all. I've heard, he said again with an unshaken and somber perseverance. There may be those who could have laughed at his pertinacity. I didn't. Oh, I didn't. There had never been a man so mercilessly shown up by his own natural impulse. A single word had stripped him of his discretion, of that discretion which is more necessary to the decencies of our inner being than clothing is to the decorum of our body. Dee, don't be a fool, I repeated. Dee, but the other man said it, you don't deny that? He pronounced distinctly, and looking in my face without flinching. And no, I don't deny, said I, returning his gaze. At last his eyes followed downwards the direction of my pointing finger. He appeared at first uncomprehending, then confounded, and at last amazed and scared, as though a dog had been a monster and he had never seen a dog before. Nobody dreamt of insulting you, I said. He contemplated the wretched animal, that moved no more than an effigy. It sat with ears pricked and its sharp muzzle pointed into the doorway, and suddenly snapped at a fly like a piece of mechanism. I looked at him. The red of his fair sunburnt complexion deepened suddenly under the down of his cheeks, invaded his forehead, spread to the roots of his curly hair. His ears became intensely crimson, and even the clear blue of his eyes was darkened many shades by the rush of blood to his head. His lips pouted a little, trembling as though he had been on the point of bursting into tears. I perceived he was incapable of pronouncing a word from the excess of his humiliation. From disappointment to who knows? Perhaps he looked forward to that hammering he was going to give me for rehabilitation, for appeasement? Who can tell what relief he expected from this chance of a row? He was naive enough to expect anything. But he had given himself away for nothing in this case. He had been frank with himself, let alone with me, in the wild hope of arriving in that way at some effective refutation, and the stars had been ironically unpropitious. He made an inarticulate noise in his throat like a man imperfectly stunned by a blow on the head. It was pitiful. I didn't catch up again with him till well outside the gate. I had even to trot a bit at the last, but when, out of breath at his elbow, I taxed him with running away, he said, never, and at once turned at bay. I explained I never meant to say he was running away from me, from no man, from not a single man on earth, he affirmed with a stubborn mien. I forbore to point out the one obvious exception which would hold good for the bravest of us. I thought he would find out by himself very soon. He looked at me patiently, while I was thinking of something to say, but I could find nothing on the spur of the moment, and he began to walk on. I kept up, and anxious not to lose him, I said hurriedly, that I couldn't think of leaving him under a false impression of my, I stammered. The stupidity of the phrase appalled me while I was trying to finish it, but the power of sentences has nothing to do with their sense, or the logic of their construction. My idiotic mumble seemed to please him. He cut it short by saying, with courteous placidity, that argued an immense power of self-control, or else a wonderful elasticity of spirits, or my mistake. I marveled greatly at this expression. He might have been alluding to some trifling occurrence. Hadn't he understood its deplorable meaning? Why, you may well forgive me, he continued, and went on a little moodily, all these staring people in court seemed such fools, that it might have been as I supposed. This opened suddenly a new view of him to my wonder. I looked at him curiously, and met his unabashed and impenetrable eyes. I can't put up with this kind of thing, he said, very simply, and I don't mean to. In court it's different. I've got to stand that, and I can do it too. I don't pretend I understood him. The views he let me have of himself were like those glimpses through the shifting rents in the thick fog, bits of vivid and vanishing detail, giving no connected idea of the general aspect of a country. They fed one's curiosity without satisfying it. They were no good for purposes of orientation. Upon the whole, he was misleading. That's how I summed him up to myself, after he left me late in the evening. I had been staying at the Malabar House for a few days, and on my pressing invitation he dined with me there. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.